The government will be accused today of not taking seriously the environmental threat posed by ever-increasing air travel. The criticism will be led by members of the Commons Environmental Audit Committee during a debate on aviation policy.
Past seven, the Commons Environmental Audit Committee has given the government a bit of a pasting in its latest report on aviation policy and global warming, accusing ministers of being irresponsible and intellectually dishonest. Now, the Aviation White Paper, which was published at the end of last year, is debated by MPs in the Commons.
Mike Fawcett was head of the Department for Transport's Airport Policy Division. He was responsible for the production of the White Paper until its publication in December 2003, and he describes its overall strategy.
One of the central decisions in the White Paper was about the amount of development of aviation in the UK over the period to 2030. And that involved a range of developments at airports all around the UK. In some airports, perhaps not so dramatic, I mean, more a sort of incremental development, making fuller use of existing runways and adding terminal capacity and taxiways and other facilities to cater for increased numbers of passengers. But in other cases, and particularly in the southeast, we were looking at some very dramatic developments with very large impacts, and in particular in terms of the number of possible new runways at airports in the southeast. And that was clearly one of the central decisions that ministers had to take. And in doing that, we had to look at the forecast growth of demand, taking account of the fact that we were looking a long way ahead, and there are inevitably some degrees of uncertainty in forecasting demand so far ahead. And so, you know, we didn't want to pretend that this was a sort of absolute certainty and sort of absolutely rigid. I mean, I think it's fair to say that if the sort of full forecast demand actually materialises, then there would have been an economic argument for perhaps having more capacity, perhaps three new runways in the southeast, but, as I say, with considerable uncertainties, and also, of course, with very large environmental impacts and with the potential for blight of a lot of people, a lot of areas over a very long period. So, in the end, I mean, ministers concluded that it would be sensible to plan for two new runways in the southeast because that would give very large economic benefits. There would be a sort of high level of certainty that that level of capacity would be well utilised. And, of course, the environmental impacts would be less than with three new runways.
The Department for Transport team certainly believes strongly that the process that led up to the White Paper was carried out in an objective and rigorous way. Chris Kane managed both the preparatory and regional consultation phases.
In terms of the various stages, the way we went about it, the material that was put in the public domain, even if different interests didn't necessarily agree with the conclusions, I think that there was actually quite a lot of respect for the way we went about it and the amount and quality of analysis that went into informing the debate and ultimately, obviously, informing, making sure the ministers had the right material to come to conclusions. And if you like, that was the job of the officials, and obviously people take their own view about the outcome of the White Paper.
But Peter Ainsworth, who chairs the Commons Environmental Audit Committee, feels that despite the elaborate process and consultation, the final decision was highly unsatisfactory.
Heathrow is one of the world's leading airports. It's where the airlines want to go. And so there was huge pressure from the industry to develop Heathrow. That's what they really wanted. However, there are capacity constraints at Heathrow, and there are also, as we know, issues to do with air quality around that. So Stansted comes into the frame, because it's there are greater opportunities for expanding, provided you don't mind about the local countryside, quality of life, air quality in that part of Essex. It is on paper easier to expand there. Gatwick is a more constrained site as well. There are physical difficulties about expanding there. And of course, they've left a question mark hanging over what they're going to do at Gatwick. It all depends on what happens with air quality at Heathrow, which is itself a fairly invidious situation. Another flaw of this whole process was that they went through all the public consultation. They did a huge amount of work. They spent vast quantities of public money on putting together this white paper, and they ended up with a kind of half answer. Yes, we're going to do Stansted. Might do Heathrow, and well, if we can't, then we'll do Gatwick. That's not an answer.
The main criticism levelled at the aviation white paper was that it failed to address properly the environmental impacts of aviation expansion, and in failing to do so, was at odds with the government's own policy on climate change. But Mike Fawcett says that there was extensive consultation with DEFRA, the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs.
I think the approach that the government took to climate change and the environment, which was, very much a consensus. I mean, there was a lot of discussion between Department for Transport and DEFRA at both official and ministerial level and over a period of some months, so that we sort of, worked together to understand the objectives of each department and what were the options and what was the best way of tackling this. And that's what led to the conclusion in the white paper that we should aim for a considerable development of aviation because of all the benefits that that brings to the British economy and the British people, but also that we should ensure that aviation is covering its external costs and its environmental costs as part of that, including its impact on global warming. So the decision in the white paper that the UK should press within international bodies such as European Union and at a global level for measures to ensure that aviation is covering those costs, in particular through sort of bringing aviation within systems of carbon trading, so that we could get the control and reduction of greenhouse gas emissions, but in a way which sort of allowed flexibility to find, well, what are the ways of doing that that sort of have the least damaging economic impact, and not just looking within one sector like aviation, but looking across sectors so that we can get the result we want on greenhouse gases while sort of having the minimum damage to economic factors. And, that was, one of the foremost issues that ministers and officials were discussing collectively.
Friends of the Earth's Richard Dyer rejects the notion that any carbon trading scheme will be enough to mitigate the environmental effects of the massive growth in aviation planned in the white paper.
There is this bland assurance that the emissions trading scheme will solve all in terms of the environmental problems, particularly climate change impacts, but no assessment really to look at how the emissions trading scheme might affect the growth in flights and what that might mean for runway capacity. So it's like, let's assume we need this capacity and let's go ahead and provide it, rather than taking stock of what needs to be done in terms of meeting climate targets and what changes in the economy might mean to those growth projections.
Peter Ainsworth's criticism is also focused on the government's failure to address aviation's impact on climate change.
In the end, we're either serious about tackling climate change or we're not. And there is no more glaring example that I can think of in terms of today's politics of a failure to join up thinking about climate change with another policy area, in this case, obviously, aviation. And so I think the right thing to have done would have been to have placed far more emphasis on those environmental impacts, which are the controversial thing about developing aviation infrastructure, and bind them into the process much earlier, instead of receiving a huge hail of bullets from environmental NGOs and local campaign groups and so on, but basically brushing them off and saying, sorry, we're going to do this anyway. And by the way, it's very balanced, which of course it isn't. My only question is how, at national level, does the British government square its commitment to reducing CO2 emissions with its commitment to trebling airport capacity? I haven't had an answer to that question. And that's why I have criticised this white paper and the entire policy as being based on a predict and provide approach towards aviation, something which I know the Department of Transport vehemently denies, but actually denial is no replacement for argument. They predicted a huge increase over the next 30 years in the amount of air travel that would be required, and they plan to meet it. That is predict and provide.
Furthermore, he feels very strongly that the main beneficiaries of the outcome will be the aviation industry itself.
To the extent that it increases the capacity of the aviation industry to ferry people around the world in an unsustainable way, they benefit. I suppose it could be argued that there might be some economic benefits in the Stansted area, although I think the economic benefits of aviation have actually been exaggerated. I mean, a lot of the jobs involved in aviation are pretty poor quality jobs. And if, you know, the overall intention is to build a sort of hub facility so that people fly in, change planes and move on somewhere else, well, who actually benefits from that? I mean, to the extent that capacity is increased, of course, the aviation industry benefits, the airlines benefit. BAA, which owns Stansted, benefits, although I think they themselves would rather see developments at Heathrow.
Richard Dyer agrees.
It's obvious that the aviation industry have done extremely well out of this. They were generally very pleased with the publication of the white paper and the appraisals it's contained. They probably would have liked Heathrow a bit sooner, but they're getting pretty much what they want. And I suppose, in a sense, some of the public are very much used to the availability of cheap flights. That would seem to be looking to continue. But to put that in perspective, that's mainly much better off people benefiting from that rather than new opportunities being provided for less well-off people. The statistics show that it's mainly ABC ones, the top social groups, the higher social groups that are flying more often and will fly more and more often with this growth than the less well-off people flying. There's still 50% of the population that don't fly. So in a way, it's getting us used to unsustainable habits that can't go on, because in a sense, the climate impacts, particularly of the sector, are increasing rapidly. The trend just cannot continue if we're going to have any chance of tackling climate change, even if we take quite radical steps with other sectors of industry and the economy to cut carbon emissions. Aviation poses quite a severe threat to that. So things are heading in completely the wrong direction. It's really living in cloud cuckoo land to expect the industry to continue to expand as it has done and continue to benefit from the effective tax breaks that it gets, which are driving the low cost of flights and therefore the growth in flights.
Both Peter Ainsworth and Richard Dyer point out that the context within which environmental debate and decisions take place has changed since the beginning of the aviation white paper process.
There's been a change in the science, there's been a change in the oil price, and there's been a change in the terms of debate around the world. Not in America, I have to say. I was listening to a man from the federal aviation industry at a conference the other day who said that they weren't really worried about climate change in aviation. Well, that's them. We don't have to go that way. You know, there are more and more people now who realise that aviation has huge, long-term and damaging consequences for the environment. And you know, we need to rethink what we're doing.
I think a number of things have happened. The price of oil has increased dramatically. And we don't really know what's going to happen with that in the longer term, but I think it'd be fair to say that oil is going to become scarcer and scarcer, so we can expect it to be a long-term trend that oil is more expensive. I think we've also seen climate change rise up the political agenda and also in public awareness as well. Certainly this year, I mean, I've been very much aware of the amount of attention in the media that climate change has had and aviation's impact on climate change particularly. And I think in a way we're at the very early stages of this awareness building, in a way that perhaps we were with the impacts of road building, say 15 years ago or so, when it wasn't really questioned that you just build new roads to solve a problem or to deal with a rise in road traffic and congestion. And now that certainly is questioned. And I think we're at very early stages with the aviation industry of that realisation that we can't really go on as we are. Only this summer we had, you know, front pages of some of the broadsheet newspapers with big article on aviation's climate change impacts. And travel writers in many of the big newspapers now writing about sustainable travel and about aviation's climate impacts in a way that one journalist said to me recently. He said, we wouldn't have done this a year ago. This is, you know, our editors wouldn't be interested in it. So I think public awareness has got a long way to go, but it's certainly rising on this issue.
Some have suggested that advances in aircraft technology could provide an environmental fix.
I'm interested in some of the technological advances which the industry is talking about, and the sooner they come, the better, to the extent that they can mitigate noise, that they can mitigate pollution, that they can mitigate the impacts on climate change. These technological developments are great. The trouble is, in the context of overwhelming growth forecasts and building airport capacity to enable that growth to take place, those technological advances are going to be a drop in the ocean. They're really not going to make any difference at all. And they won't make any difference until you can devise a technology which doesn't use fossil fuel to get aeroplanes off the ground. So I welcome that, and there's a lot of good work going on. But actually, in the end, it's about how serious we are about climate change. And I'm sorry to keep coming back to it, but that is actually the bottom line. And if we are serious about it, and my goodness, we need to be, then we are going to have to constrain the growth that aviation wants to see in the years ahead.
We simply can't have the rate of growth we've been experiencing and what's projected into the future to continue. It's possible that we could accommodate some growth in flights, perhaps what technology could accommodate. We can expect probably about a 1% efficiency improvements in aircraft technology. But we're seeing growth in this country of more than 6% a year at the moment, and with no prospect of a radical change of aircraft technology to solve the problem, it's simply irresponsible to go on increasing the amount that we fly.
But what would be the effectiveness of other proposals to limit aviation's growth?
They've already said they want to bring aviation into emissions trading. This is the European Commission. I think we could see quite a firm proposal on the design of that scheme. And that's really critical because emissions trading can be an ineffective SOP to the industry, or it can be a very effective tool at combating aircraft emissions. So the devil is really going to be in the detail as far as that goes. Some parts of the industry want an emissions trading scheme that just covers intra-EU flights between European airports. And we and the European Commission want the emissions trading scheme to cover all departures from EU airports. So that would cover flights, say, to the US from our airports in the EU. And the amount of emissions that the scheme would cover radically differs depending on which of those options you go for.
Peter Ainsworth favours focusing on taxation as a means of controlling aviation growth.
They get a very favourable tax deal at the moment. There's no tax on aviation fuel, for example. There's no VAT on tickets. You can't impose tax on aviation fuel without getting an international agreement to do so, and there are obstacles about that, but we should at least be discussing that in an international context. We have a thing called air passenger duty in this country, which everyone pays, but which is not related in any way to the emissions that come out of the back end of an aeroplane. So having an emissions charge would, I think, be a creative thing to do. I personally, and what my committee recommended, would like to see the proceeds of that reinvested in technologies which can help reduce the impact of aviation on the environment. So there are all sorts of fiscal measures that you can achieve. You can contain the problem by not trebling airport capacity, but by building perhaps on a more limited scale. You can explain to the public by telling them on their tickets how much carbon that journey is releasing into the atmosphere. And there's a huge public ignorance about this. You know, people think that a £19 flight to Malaga is just that. Actually, you know, there are huge potential costs attached to that for which nobody's paying at the moment. That needs to be reflected. So that public awareness grows. And the true cost of aviation is actually borne by those who want to fly.
Richard Dyer thinks that sooner or later, we are all going to have to make choices about the environmental costs of our lifestyles.
The government have commendably taken climate change quite seriously, at least with their words. But they should be saying things like, well, we've got to make decisions about where these cuts are going to come from in terms of CO2. It's going to mean decisions eventually about how much you can drive your car and weighing that up with how many cheap flights do you want, or are you allowed to have any cheap flights, or can you heat your home and have cheap flights? I'm sticking my neck out here, but eventually we're going to be looking at decisions like that if we carry on going down the road that we're going down, because we can't have everything. We've got to cut carbon emissions from all sources, and aviation has got to play its part in that. And I don't think at the moment the government are being honest with representing the depth of the problem as it actually is.
So who will be the losers if aviation grows unfettered in the way that's been predicted and planned for in the aviation white paper?
People who live near the airport lose out. They lose out because of noise, pollution, all the environmental problems. And because aviation has a particularly intense impact on climate change, we all lose.
We all lose out to an extent, obviously, from climate change when it eventually kicks in much more strongly. But also, in a sense, the less well-off amongst us are losing out because of, you know, the loss to the public purse of this income. So effectively, we're subsidising better-off people to fly more often, and that money could be going towards public services that benefit all and perhaps more the less well-off people. And that seems a crazy state of affairs when something is, you know, such an environmentally damaging form of transport. And it's mainly a leisure activity as well. The growth is mainly going to be in leisure travel rather than business travel that arguably has more benefit to the economy.
Richard Dyer predicts that the government's plans are unlikely to be carried out without serious challenges from at least some sections of the public.
I think in the long term, it's quite likely that we will see some sort of direct action. Communities around airports are getting increasingly angry. We get contacted every few weeks by a new group that's formed, totally shocked and angry about some new proposal that's been published by their local airport. Those impacts are going to be felt all over the place, and so I think that people are getting very angry. We've heard, you hear about public meetings where hundreds of people couldn't get in to the small room the meeting was booked for because people are so angry. Those fears are going to be brought more into reality when we start to see diggers out there and the first signs of concrete on the ground, and I think that's when we could see direct action taking place. It's certainly feasible. I mean, it's happened recently on road schemes, so I certainly wouldn't rule it out.
Only time will tell what the outcome will be. But even during the consultation process, Norman Mead, the General Secretary of Stop Stansted Expansion, was warning of militant action.
I stress straight away we're not swampies. What does concern me is there are a lot of people that we have been holding back at the moment who wish to take far more militant action than we have seen fit. They've gone along with us so far, and all credit to them for doing it. But I will have a job to hold them back if proposals like that come to the fore. They will be looking at closing runways and stopping up the airport and things like that. And I won't be able to stop them at that point.